The book review. One of the things that I have looked forward to over the last 20-odd years, I think, at this time of the year, is the new Jack Reacher novel. It has been... it's a bit silly because I read quite quickly, as I think you might know. So the Reacher book takes me about 2.5 hours to read. So I wait for it for 6 months and then it arrives and I read it in 2.5 hours and then I have to wait another year for the next one. And he announced some time ago that he was moving away from full-time writing of the Reacher series, and he was essentially handing over the controlling reins to his brother, Andrew Child, who has previously been... he has been published under Andrew Grant, which is the family surname. And the first of that collaboration is out. It is called The Sentinel. And on the front it says, the new Jack Reacher, Lee Child, the world's number one bestseller, and Andrew Child. And I was so disappointed. I really wanted to like it. I really wanted to believe that the series was going to continue. There was a sense that Child was kind of running out of inspiration and running out of steam. A lot of people felt that his most recent couple of books were not as good as some of the ones at the beginning and in the middle. But I thought the one prior to this was a return to form. I thought, maybe my expectations were too high. And I sort of checked in on the quality papers, The Guardian and The New York Times and The Telegraph and places that do a lot of book reviews. And unanimously, those reviewers were feeling the same way that I did. When you go to something like Goodreads and the sort of consumer sites of criticism, it gets a more nuance. Some people really like it. Some people don't see the difference and so on. But for me, it's like you have a recipe and you work so long with that recipe that you no longer read the recipe, whether you're making, I don't know, a bolognese sauce or a sourdough bread. You've done it so often that you've forgotten the recipe. You just do it. And because you've done it so often and so well, every time you produce something as good as, if not better, maybe an occasional flop. Whereas this one is somebody who's got the recipe and is applying the recipe for the first time. So the story is the sort of story that you would expect with a Reacher novel. He gets off a bus in a sleepy, no-name town outside Nashville in Tennessee. His only plan is to grab a cup of coffee and move right along. But hey, this is a Reacher novel, so that's not going to happen. The town has been shut down by a cyber attack, and there's an everyman at the center of this, Rusty Rutherford. He's an average IT guy, but he knows more than he thinks. There's some really bad people who want to get hold of Rusty. And as the bad guys move in on Rusty, Reacher moves in on them. And it's, you know, typical Reacher plot. And all of the ingredients are there, but they are, it's show, not tell. I mean, it's tell, not show. So Reacher's traditionally laconic, whereas here he just talks so much. No, Reacher doesn't talk. Reacher does. And everything is explained instead of happening under the surface. And I hate saying it, but, you know, if you're a Reacher fan, don't be put off by my review. You might feel as the many people around the world who've reviewed on Amazon and Goodreads feel and think it's wonderful. I didn't, The Sentinel. Very, very sad to say that. A very, very charming book. One of the more charming, compassionate, kind, gentle books that I've read in fiction this year is called The Dictionary of Lost Words. And it's yet another debut novel this year. I can't recall a year where I have read as many excellent debut novels. This is by a writer from Adelaide called Pip Williams. And there was a bidding war for her book, and eventually a firm press got the bidding rights. And it tells the story of somebody called Esme. Esme died in childbirth, so her constant companion, her role model, is her father, who's a lexicographer. And he's one of those lexicographers who is putting together the Oxford English Dictionary. This is a story that was told in the non-fiction bestseller by Simon Winchester, the surgeon of Crowthorne. And she spends her childhood under a table in the thing called the scriptorium, the editor of the Oxford Dictionary putting it together for the first time. It was a shed in James Murray's backyard, but they called it the scriptorium. And there James Murray and his assistants, one of them Esme's father, are assembling the dictionary in a truly meticulous way. The building blocks are masses of words on slips of paper, and these have been sent in by volunteers from the world. And one of the editors says at one point, "We have embarked on the verb go, and I suspect it will consume us for months." And that's the attitude towards the building of this dictionary, and it's this quiet, dedicated, behind-the-scenes stuff. And Esme is a perfect narrator for her time and her place, because she's observing not just from the sidelines of the dictionary, but of conventional middle-class femininity. I mean, she has unusual role models, the Murray's indentured maid Lizzie, and an intellectual family friend, Ditta, who is based on a real character. And she is also very interested in the burgeoning suffragette movement. One of the most wonderful relationships in the book is the actress who she befriends, who takes center stage for a while. But Esme also wants to contribute something meaningful. As a child, she has always compulsively stolen words, but she's conscientious, so she only steals words that she calculates are, in her words, superfluous to need. And she stashes them in a secret suitcase under Lizzie's bed. One of the words that she steals is the word bondmaid. And that word is then subsequently found absent from the dictionary's first edition. And that is an historical fact. And this real-life absence of this book is the detail from history that Williams took as her starting inspiration for the novel. But then she crosses to womanhood, and both the dictionary and Esme's father fail her for the first time. He's very uncomfortable. He doesn't want to acknowledge the word menstruation. Not one of them could fully explain what had happened to me. She searches the scriptorium for words and definitions that reflect her experience as a growing woman. She doesn't find them. They are not in that book. So she assembles her own rogue dictionary of lost words. The official dictionary requires quotations from publications that represent the middle and upper classes, who are mostly men. So Esme gets her words verbally, chiefly from Lizzie and from the working women at the local market, including a retired prostitute who becomes a valued source. And this retired prostitute says to Esme, "Nothing I've ever said has ever been written down." And it's just such a gentle book. It's a kind book. It's never sentimental, because often kindness and sentimentality in literature can be intermingled. There are no villains. There is conflict, yes, but there are no villains, because even the one who is most opposed to what Esme is doing understands, has a vague sense of the perspective which she is bringing. And at a time of Trump and Bolsonaro and Viktor Orban and COVID-19, to have a book in which you can just settle into kindness is a wonderful gift. It's called The Dictionary of Lost Words by Pip Williams. And then, appropriate for the 16 days of activism period that we're in, is a book called Men Who Hate Women. It's by Laura Bates, who founded, prior to the Me Too movement, she founded something called the Everyday Sexism Project, which is a space where women could convey their experiences of everyday sexism. And in this book, which is subtitled From Incels to Pickup Artists, The Truth About Extreme Misogyny and How It Affects Us All, what she did was create a cover as a disillusioned young man called Alex, and then she travels through these message boards in these strange places where misogynist men gather. The manosphere is what it is called. And she writes about the incels, shorthand for involuntary celibates. Nature gave them women a bunch of social and sexual advantages to compensate for their lack of resources. This is a typical post from an incel user. Now that they have resource and sex power, things are out of balance. We need to prevent females from going to university or taking family-supporting jobs. Our prisons are full of men who could not feed their families. The rape laws should be repealed. Females are artificially restricting the supply of available females in their reproductive years. Rape is the answer. This is the kind of message board posting. But incels, you know, Elliot Rodger killed six people in the US in a day of retribution in 2014. He was inspired by the incel movement. And then, you know, she goes to the PUAs, the pickup artists, a group called MGTOW, men going their own way, men's rights activists who pretend to care about the very real problem in men's lives in order to blame it all on the feminists. And these are really fettered people. And I would imagine that many men who think of themselves as vaguely sane and compassionate and if not feminist, then not disrespectful or misogynist in any significant way, would probably wouldn't recognize themselves. But one of the great successes of the book for me is that Laura Bates says, don't go them and us. Because although these are extreme examples, this kind of attitude filters into what Boris Johnson and Donald Trump and people like that say about women. I thought it was a very brave and very important book. Women have always been the canaries in the coal mines, quietly singing, but we're so used to seeing them die at men's hands, so used to justifying and excusing it as normal or understandable, that it wouldn't occur to us to consider this enough of an aberration to raise alarm. And so women continue to suffer and die in silence. And sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months down the line, men, or rather, as they like to be seen, people die too. Then how we shout and react. The only issue really is that the kind of people who most need to read it are not going to read it. So in a sense, there's a preaching to a converted audience. But it's a very, very powerful sermon that she delivers. Laura Bates, the author of Men Who Hate Women.